This episode is supported by ZavoLife. And let me tell you, I've actually been using this every day. I just mix a teaspoon into my morning smoothie, and it gives me this clean, steady energy that doesn't feel like a crash later in the day. What surprised me most is how much better my digestion and focus have been since I added it into my diet. It's packed with over 50% plant-based proteins, essential vitamins, minerals, fibers, and antioxidants. Literally a whole nutrient boost in one scoop. And honestly, I feel it when I don't take it. Have you ever been looking for something simple that actually supports your energy, gut health, and even skin and hair? This is it. My listeners get 30% off their entire order with my promo code ZeroSignal. That's the biggest discount they offer anywhere. Just go to zavo.life and use code ZeroSignal at checkout. Again, that's zavo.life, code ZeroSignal. Try it for 30 days, risk-free, and see if you notice the difference, like I did.
You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelts.
Welcome back to Zero Signal. I am David, and as always, I'm sitting here with my co-host, Jay. Today, we're going back to the NASA archives and into a mystery that's been hiding in plain sight for almost 60 years. My guest is a historian and researcher, Ed Wilson, author of a two-part nonfiction investigation, The Simskin NASA Archive UFO and Hidden Under Your Nose. Across these books, Ed documents more than 150 early NASA photographs. Some of them, once secret, digs into Gemini 11 mission transcripts and technical debriefing, and uses modern forensic imaging and AI to argue that NASA's own archival photos and film show a consistent, unexplained craft, a genuine UFO in the Gemini 11 material. And that's been effectively hidden in plain sight for decades. His work hasn't stayed on the fringe. It's been taken seriously by scientists, journalists, congressional staff, and is currently under study by the House Oversight Committee UAP investigation. Tonight, we're going to talk about what he found in those archives, why it matters for NASA's history, and how Cold War secrecy may still be shaping what we think about what we know about space. But before we dive into all that, let's start with the person behind the lens. Ed, for people who are just meeting you through this conversation, who are you and how do you describe what you do?
I want to say thanks to everybody out there. It's nice to have a chance to talk to people who are informed. My name is Ed Wilson, and I have a different background from most UFO researchers today. Originally, I was a historian and rare book and document dealer. That was only until I rediscovered what is the most important piece of NASA photography ever. We're going to be talking about a lot of pictures. For God's sake, I've got all the pictures. You'll be able to see them on my book covers, both front and back. I've got all the pictures of the UFO you want. You don't have to buy it. My idea is to get the pictures out there, but don't wreck your car if you're driving. The name is Simkinson. I just did a podcast in England, and they didn't realize that it's not. I just think of Bart Simpkins, right? Remember the beautiful cartoon, The Simpsons? Everybody loves The Simpsons. This is Simkinson with a K-I-N. So S-I-M-P-K-I-N-S-O-N. Go to Amazon, and they show lovely pictures, front covers, both books that are already there. You can see these things without paying for anything. I'll hold some of these photos, these covers up for you guys to see them and other photos. The photos are great. As I said, that's the Simkinson NASA Archive UFO. And the only reason it survived is because NASA's original Space Task Group chief engineer, Scott Simkinson, preserved it in his personal archive, where it sat untouched in the family basement since 1996. When I first saw it, it's obvious immediately. When you see it, it's an indisputable flying saucer. I began cross-checking it against NASA's own material. The lithograph wasn't an isolated incident. The same object shows up again in NASA's official Gemini 11 Hasselblad photographs, in one Maurer camera photograph, and again in the never-before-seen 16,000-frame RCA D-15 mission film I recovered from the National Archives. And when you line them all up, the secret lithograph, the public NASA photos, the hidden RC camera footage, the objects match in all of them. They're different angles, different lighting, and different cameras, but it's the same craft. We're dealing with a documented sequence of events NASA never intended the public to see. This isn't folklore. This isn't a story someone told somebody. This is forensic archival scientific evidence. We have have NASA astronaut voice transcripts reporting weird craft in real time. We have NASA's technical debriefings where the astronauts deny seeing any anomalies, except one, the exact anomaly that occurred during the D-15 battery failure. And again, we have a 6-minute communications gap, which is a classic signature marker in NASA anomalous events. We have a perfect, indisputable cloud pattern match between the lithograph and NASA's own frame S66-54585, a scientifically verifiable match that proves the lithograph originated from a real NASA Gemini 11 photograph. We have timestamp artifacts on the RCA film that indicate missing digital frames that should exist, and you can read it for yourself in NASA's own Johnson Space Center oral history, the testimony from NASA's legendary photographic director, Richard Underwood. In his official oral history interview, he states clearly that no one outside a small security cleared group has ever seen a first-generation NASA photograph. Every image the public has ever seen, every image researchers have ever seen, every image you've ever seen, and Congress too, is from a third generation negative. Make sure you understand what this means. It means we have never seen the original NASA negatives. So when you take all of this together, the lost lithograph, the matching Hasselblad photo, the 16,000 frames of hidden RCA footage, the astronaut transcripts, the cloud pattern verification, the missing timestamps, the National Archives recovery, and the CIA MPIC duplication systems, we now know we're in operation. That's something NASA can't explain. The craft in these frames are not lights. They are not lens flares. They are not reflections. They are structured objects photographed by NASA across multiple camera systems. It's all 100% NASA imagery. Don't take my word for it. Follow the NASA trail and believe your own eyes. The American public deserves transparency, and that's why I'm here today. Now you know exactly what some of these topics are. I'm ready to discuss wherever you guys would like to start. Maybe you'd like to start with a picture. Let me hold one up. When you want to see a picture, just go to Amazon website. The name is Simpkins UFO. That's the book cover. When you take away all that print, the white lettering and stuff, that is the actual 6x9 inch lithograph that I found in the back of the Gemini 11 binder, one of 31 binders of imagery that I had purchased from an auction. And I had no idea it was in there. Now, this book is filled with over 150 artifacts. Let's close in a little bit so that you can see what that UFO actually looks like. Do you see the glow around it?
Yeah.
Do you see how the lights, the portholes are not even? And that's right. What originally people thought, oh, that's a cheap. They can't even make the portholes even. They're not portholes. Not really sure what they are, but I think they're more than likely energy dispersal systems. The way the craft works and what I know now from some of the newest engineering feats being done on the nano engineering level, that hull is layered metamaterials. That is energy being dispersed. That's an energy dispersal system, and it's verified by the aura around it. That's a 1966 Sammy. There's an 80-page report from Microtrace Laboratories in Chicago, Illinois. I paid $5,000 for this report, okay? And that's been back when Whoppers were two for $5. It's an extensive scientific report. You look on the back, those color images are part of the 80-page report. They did an analysis of the lithograph. I have the chain of custody documentation on the back. You can look at them. You can see for yourself what's going on. This is the interesting photo right here. This is who these guys are. You see that photograph? That's the very first Mercury capsule the United States ever built. And those guys are the group of engineers from Lewis Field. It was called Lewis Field back when it was the Army Air Corps. And that was the research center for the Army Air Corps. Lewis Field was where NACA, the predecessor to NASA, lived. And that guy right there in the center, next to that lovely girl, the big tubby one, that's Scott Hudson. And that's his secretary who was there with him to the day of his death. You can read about it. She was there. There's another archive from his office in Cape Canaveral. When he died, she was living with him in Houston, and that's where the Johnson Space Center was. He had an office in the Johnson Space Center, and that's where my archive came from. When he died, she had to go all the way to Cape Canaveral, and she was alone. She never married. They didn't have any. She donated what was in his office there to the University of Southern Florida. You can find that documented, too, and it says right there was donated by Emily. So they were never married, but in all the documents found inside, you can hear the astronauts. There's cards and birthday images, and the photos in here are amazing. This is going to be the finest archive of the earliest NASA photos ever. Here's exactly why. This is the guy who took those boys from Cleveland and formed NASA. That was the very first NASA space capsule. He was the guy who pushed the button that lit it off. Not only that, but he built the blockhouses inside. Just some of the beautiful pictures. That's inside the very first blockhouse. There's one of the missiles he's launched. You just won't find these anywhere else. That's Scott Hudson, the head of NASA at that time, George Lowe. That guy standing next to him is the first American in outer space. And the guy in the bow tie, that's Scott. That's the first
for Scottsdale that they're going to launch him on. Yeah. So that's how wonderful
this archive is for you.
These are all big. This is a 9.5 by 11.
Nobody else has this collection of photos. This is from the guy who built the blockhouses, the head engineer, the lead engineer you saw around the first capsule he built. Got pictures of him in there with the President Eisenhower. You just saw America's very first astronaut there. The archive is beautiful, over 150 pictures. Many a secret. You can see the components of the Atlas rocket that they launched these guys up on. You can see exactly every wire and what it was done. Those were secret. Nobody was supposed to see those. That was our ICBM missile. And that's how brave these guys were. These brave guys were so brave. Everyone remembers there were 9 manned Mercury missions, but he includes all the documentation for all 17 Mercury missions. There were 17 Mercury missions. Only 9 of them were manned. You've got the beautiful pictures of the chimpanzees that they launched off into space and they just eating fruit and stuff after they got back successfully. Heritage Auctions in Dallas, Texas. I make my living on rare books and documents. And I knew that these were valuable photos. That's why I bought the archive before I knew that lithograph was in there. I'm a historian. That's the origins of NASA when it was still NACA, okay? So that's, to me, as a historian, is the most valuable thing ever. And the lesser ones, the guys landing on the moon and stuff, I sold those off. I sold 232 of those photographs at Heritage Auctions for over $80,000. The pictures in this book are not jokes. This whole collection is not a joke. You can go to Heritage Auctions, and I made sure they listed it as from the archive of Scott Simpkins. So this is not a joke. When you got guys spending $80,000, to me, that says a lot. There's a lot of investigation that I do and resources, and I know you want to do it too. When it comes to money, a lot of us say that's proof enough. So if you want proof that this is a valid archive, you can look that up just by going to Heritage Auctions.
Were you shocked to find some of these pictures when you bought this set off the auction?
My business is collecting stuff and getting it into museums and not letting it be wasted. So I knew that the pictures were great. The authenticity of them had to be verified. As a rare book and document dealer, the reason I research so much is I spend lots of money to buy things at auction, but I have to know that they're valid. If I buy something and it's a fake, I lose my entire investment. So my whole life revolves around documenting genuine nature of artifacts. I knew what they were, and I said, these are valuable if they're real. So I had to go there and verify for myself that they were the real thing, and obviously they were. I was so pleased. There were rare documents, and I still have those. I will auction those off eventually, but there were things in there that didn't belong, and that's where the confusion came in. You saw Emily Earle there. In the first book, there's a whole page of a NASA newsletter from mid-60s. It's got a lovely picture of Emily. Everything I tell you is from a document. Not me making any of that. You'll see it with your own eyes. It says Emily Erdl of such and such a department was the first female employee at Cape Canaveral. So not only is Scott Simk the guy who built the rockets and the blockhouse, but his main squeeze, Emily, was the very first female employee at NASA. She started at NACA in 1945. Simpkinson started at NACA in 1943. He got out of college with a mechanical engineering degree. I believe it was the University of Cincinnati. And from there, he went up to Lewis Field, where he was hired to be an engineer. He started out modifying and destructive testing of propellers. Now, 43 was right in the middle of World War II. It was in 1943, so he was working on propellers, and destructive testing was the methodology that he was a specialist in. Now, whether you realize it or not, when you're working with new fields, the most important thing is destructive testing. It's why people see Elon Musk launch one of those skyscrapers into the air, and then it gets up there, and it blows up, and then you see everybody in the control room cheering wildly, and people are going, what's going on? I just blew up. That's what Scott Simpkinson was a specialist in, and it's exactly what Elon Musk is doing now. It's called destructive testing. It's new technology that is only theorized and not proven, and the only way to prove it is to test it until it blows up, and that's what he was a specialist in. Doing propellers in 1943, the war ended in 45. 2 years later, he moved on to a place called Wallet Island. He was still with NACA running experiments out there because he has some of the photographs in this archive. You'll see him in there. He was testing Nazi V-2 rockets. So that's 1945. This guy was classified from the very beginning. His security clearances were top because he was doing experimental work on military propellers, improving them, and then into the V-2 rockets and rocket technology. And so that goes way back to World War II. You have to realize there's a train of evidence that's going to be followed through all these books, and it's what's made it so difficult and why no one has ever pieced it together. You have things that you have to take in consideration, such as was working for NACA. The documents that I found show that NACA was actually affiliated, and the guys were running it were, and now I use terms loosely, but this is what I mean by difficult to follow. They were CIA related even at that time. What makes it difficult is it wasn't the CIA, it was the OSS. They changed names from time to time. And that's why it's hard to do a good Freedom of Information Act, because you don't know exactly who gets custody of what and where to send it. And that's all spycraft. There's methodology that is used to keep it secret. I understand it, and you understand it too. I'm not against all of it, because some of it should be released. But you got to remember, these guys are risking their lives, okay? They're military men. We pay them to kill people. As a taxpayer, I've got to say, I'm not going to begrudge them. The whole world is a dangerous and horrifying place, and I'm just as bad as anybody else when I get pushed into a corner. So I'm not going to hold it against them. If my son or daughter were in the military and these things can be used to kill them, I don't want them released.
So let me ask you this, right? You held up a picture on your book that it fairly looks like a UFO. Can you describe for the audience what we're looking at? It's a little bit hard to distinguish exactly, but can you describe what's in that photo? Do you think the federal government is intentionally withholding this information from people? And if so, why?
This picture was done for me by Mark Brabe. Mark Brabe worked on some of the images necessary for Gary Nolan's movies. He's in Cleveland, so he's an experienced graphic artist, does wonderful work. Let's see if I can get this up. So this is a composite photograph that he put for me. This is what's going to be on the third book that is going to come this January. I'm working as fast as I can to get this done and try to do some podcasts at the same time. What you're looking at here is a NASA photograph, and the red lit number label is S6654585 from the Gemini 11 mission. Now, for everybody out here, you have to get familiar with where you can find some of this information so that you can do it with your own eyes. NASA is no longer in the early image. And so they turned it over to Arizona State University. So when you get on a computer, just go ASU March to the Moon. And March to the Moon means from man's early start in space, marched all the way to the moon. The Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo missions, every single photo NASA says it has. And guess what? It is every single photo NASA has. They did not get them off. We will get into how that's done and how we've been misled. But that's where you go to the ASU March to the Moon, and then you just follow all the links. You go to NASA Hasselblad photos, Gemini 11, and then put the number in S6654585. There's a series of five images taken all within 90 where they're coming up on the target. You can find that at Arizona State University, S6654585. There's a small image. If you blow it up close, yeah, you can see the nose of the spacecraft approaching the target. They had just finished a tether experiment. They tied a tether to the Agena and did an artificial gravity experiment. They rotated it, and that slow rotation, they let go of a pin, and the pin went to the wall and held up. At that time, they did not know if the physics behind that would work in space. They had 12 different missions that they performed on this important Gemini 11 mission experiment. This is October 1966. Less than 3 years from that mission, they landed Neil Armstrong on the moon. The next mission, Gemini 12, is within 30 days. It's a breakneck speed that these guys were working at. Breakneck. The amount of documentation that has to be done is phenomenal. The Gemini mission report was secret for 12 years. I've got a copy of it right in the book. The title page shows, and it reads right there, not to be released for 12 years. The same thing with the technical debriefing. The purpose of that debriefing is to get you fresh from the experience so that we can get every detail and make sure that it's recorded. So I've got the Gemini 11 debriefing document, and that's where you find the incident where they describe that they never saw any anomaly except one, and that was right during this D-15 experiment. The Gemini 11 mission lasted for 3 days. There's a constant influx of voice transmissions. They go from the capsule, and they're listed as to who said it, either the commander or the pilot, and which station they were talking to. Was it NASA Florida, or was it NASA Australia, or Canberra, or the various stations? We didn't have satellites back then. Boys and girls, I know how to use a slide rule. Without cell phones, how did you get a newspaper? When the Apollo 13 mission exploded in space, you all recall that, right? Safety engineer for Apollo 13 was Scott Simpkin. When Apollo 1 caught fire in the pure oxygen atmosphere on the launch pad, we lost 3 astronauts that day. To honor them, they called that the Apollo 1 mission. Now we know not to put pure oxygen where there's electrical equipment. These things seem like they're self-evident today. none of these things were known. That first mission you saw was the first testing of the ablative shield. They didn't know if that would work or if it would burn up into space. They were testing things like solid titanium shields. That's not viable because the rockets were so weak back then. The little ICBM missiles could barely lift these guys up. That they were giving the astronauts like 6 ounces of personal items they could take. The astronauts were small because we could not lift safely. We did not have these capabilities. But that Gemini 11 mission had 12 experiments. The first experiment they did, they had to open the door and throw it out the hatch. There was not enough room in there for them to continue. But the primary mission of Gemini 11 was successfully incorporated. Of all the 12 experiments, the most important one was they launched the Agena rocket up first so that it's in orbit. And then the real test that they had to do before they could get to the moon was they launched the Gemini 11 up and it had to rendezvous with that Agena capsule and hook up within one orbit. If it could not do that, then there's no way they could launch the lunar module back up from the moon and hook up with the command module all within one orbit while they had enough fuel. That is the landmark test. The other 11 tests were also great too. The artificial gravity experiment. We'll get into D-15, which is actually a spy camera. The first TV camera in space was an important experiment. You might not remember the headlines, but it broke the record for the world's highest orbit. The Gemini 11, once they hooked up to the Agena capsule, they didn't know if this would work or not. They fired that baby up and went 867 nautical miles high, which was not broken until last summer. Last summer was the first time anyone orbited higher, and it was only a couple miles higher than that. And of course, that's important because that demonstrated that by hooking up to a new rocket engine, you'd be able to get to the moon. These things were unknown. It's amazing how destructive testing has to be done, but they had to get that done. The secret mission report was 354 pages. We did not have the internet. We had to send paper copies. Now, in the back page of that mission report, there are 22 solid pages, and this is great for researchers. Anyone doing research, get into that mission report. It'll tell you every aspect, every photo that was ever taken, every experiment, the status of the experiment, what happened, diagrams of what they had. The rear 22 pages contain this. They contain 200 some names and addresses of the engineers and departments involved in that NASA flight. The whole report was classified or secret for 12 years. There was no other way to get information to people without printing it up. You're not going to wire that over a newspaper wire system. You have to get that hard copy report into the hands of McDonnell Douglas, the Pentagon. There's 200 different offices and companies that all were involved in the process. So that 320-page report to those, and not only that, it's like McDonnell Douglas. You read McDonnell Douglas, and it'll say how many copies were sent. And they sent them 18 copies. The reason they tell you how many copies are sent is because it's classified information, secret for 12 years. They need to know where every single copy of that went so that it cannot get into the enemy. So now you do a little bit of mathematics on that thing. Those rear 22 pages, the 200-some-plus reports that were made, and you have the actual offices that you can go to search for new leads. You guys out there and researchers, I'm counting on you to read this stuff so that you know where to find the new information. If I had the strength and young enough, I would be looking at those 22 pages and going over them with a fine-tooth comb and looking for names and reading the names, and then I'd be looking at the family of the names. I'd find the nearest relatives, and I would be talking to them about, did your dad leave you any documents? Someone can find. There's treasure out there, guys. So this is a map to the treasure. But I'm trying to get to how difficult things were done back then. The records that were being broke, the missions that had never been done before. The D-15 was the first television camera in space. From those 22 pages, you get the exact number of copies they had to make of just the mission report. This is not the voice transmissions, not the debriefing films. Just that report alone, when you calculate the pages in it and the number of copies that had to be printed and sent and then retrieved, it comes to over 320,000 pages. Not only that, this is the breakneck speed and the criticality of trying to beat the Russian threat. It was a matter of life and death. Those 320,000 pages had to be printed up. They had to be got into the hands of the engineering staff in all these 200 plus addresses. The engineers had to read them, see if it was a success or failure, analyze it, make any improvements, and get any improvements or status changes back to NASA before they launched Gemini 12. 30 days later. This is a gargantuan undertaking, the likes of which I think the D-Day invasion has no comparability. So these things that were done back there, kids, this is a different time. So what's the relationship in some of the proof? There we see the actual photograph. You can find it at March to the Moon, S-66.
54585. And when you close in, there's the nose of the Gemini capsule. There's the unhooked tether, and that's the Agena craft that they did all of their documenting with. You can see the Earth horizon, the curvature of the Earth, probably about 154 miles, and you can see the cloud patterns on there. See the clouds? Those clouds are clear, right? But now let me tell you what we've had done, and this will be on the cover of the book. The big one is S66-54585. That's the official red number NASA photo. This black insert right here, you see that? When you go to page 4 of the Gemini 11 mission report, you can download it from NASA, get into the NASA archives, download the entire report. This is what's on page 4. The first 3 pages are documents signed by heads of NASA saying nobody can see this for 12 years. The very first page of the report after all that subterfuge is page 4. And on page 4 is this black image. It has a number. And guess what? That number is not listed anywhere in any NASA archive. It's got a black label number that nobody knows about. I've been FOIA'd in the National Archives trying to find it, but there's no listing of that as a real photo. And that's because you can see it's just a blown up image for the CIA. Why would that be the very first photo in that important mission report? It comes from S66-54585. The most important mission, of course, was the rendezvous. We can see its part because the cloud pattern matches. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's the lithograph. And you see the clouds underneath it? Those clouds match exactly. So the clouds in the lithograph match S66-54585, just as the unknown document page 4 match S66-54585. This is one that I did of myself. The Mark Braven one is such and such. This is from Travis Taylor. Travis Taylor does a report on page 555 of my book. Travis Taylor, for those of you who aren't familiar, Skinwalker Ranch and all that. He's a NASA. His business at NASA was photo analysis. He's a photo specialist. He does a 20-page report in my book. So I put this poster together. This is page 555, and he's analyzing my lithograph, trying to detect whether or not it's real. This was before anyone ever found me. I'm the one who discovered the match just through headedness. I finally looked and let me expand this picture. I expanded a little corner of that thing. In that little corner, the cloud pattern matched. But this is what he found. There's UFO. What he's done here, this is the lithograph. What you're seeing is the UFO and the clouds underneath it that I matched 2 years after this report. He's pointing out orbital debris. There's a piece of orbital debris there and a piece of orbital debris there. When I first discovered that the images were similar, I did this and did analog production. There's the lithograph and there's the cloud pattern from the photograph, and they match. The interesting thing is that orbital debris he finds in the lithograph is not visible in the actual S66-54585, which means is a real image. It contains the orbital debris. S66-54585 has the orbital debris removed. It's a doctored photograph. Interesting.
So I ask, what do you think they are? Do you think they're from a different galaxy, interdimensional?
We can talk about this kind in particular. The universe is such a large thing, and we know very little. Our physics is rudimentary. Most of the stuff we know is correct to a certain degree, but most of it's wrong. When you talk about having to invent black holes and dark energy and dark matter, you're basically talking about cheating. You've got a model and you say, yes, this model is right, but you have to invent something to keep the numbers from going to infinity. We'll call it dark matter. We'll call it dark energy. The model is as correct as we can get. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying there are parts of it that are so wrong that we're getting numbers that aren't realistic. If the model doesn't work everywhere, that means the model is wrong to me. That said, it's very hard for me to understand the significance of time as it is to anyone. What is time? Is it a three-dimensional structure? I particularly favor looking at the origami-shaped universe or the sitter space. How do you describe things? Multi-dimension. We don't even know which of these things may be the right one. I say you have to admit that my belief is there's more to the universe than just one. I've done a couple papers using some of the latest technology I can find on metamaterials that we're using to build these supercomputer chips. We're talking nanometer technology, all those electric currents traveling almost at an atomic scale. Well, they're working on that. I find particularly interesting, Simons Foundation puts out a magazine called Quanta Magazine. I recommend it to everybody because it links every document so that you can read the actual scientific paper involved. Just click on it and read the paper for yourself. I'm a skeptic, okay? I want to read the paper. I trust your expertise, but I want to read it. And everybody lies. Human beings, we're such horrible creatures. But it's the stuff that I found out, a lot of this is spycraft. Did I show you yet? This is
why do they want to hide it from the American public? Is it classified secrets they don't want it to get into Russian and Chinese hands? Or why are they keeping it from
First of all, yes, Russian and Chinese hands. This is the story. This is what happened. This is from the CIA document that's presented. The 10 documents that are coming out in the new book. I have the actual numbers. These are actual CIA documents from the CIA reading room. You need to go to the CIA reading room. You can get online, just put CIA reading room. They said, oh, we're giving you every single file. It's right there. Guess what? They're not put together in a way that you can find the document easily. So I'm spending hours trying to find the original documents. And this is spycraft. Spycraft is, yes, I've given you the document. And that's it. It's right there. And what they give you is a haystack and you're trying to find the needle. Same thing they just did with the Epstein file. When you get into these CIA files, I have the actual numbers. And even then, you'll have a hard time backtracking them. I got into 1956 and 1958. The Automat file is the creation of the National Photographic Interpretive Center. It's a series of 80 pages of documents on the creation of the National Photographic Interpretive Center, created by the CIA in 1956 as follow-up to other military map-making facilities. We'll get back to the one document that will answer your question in part. There's a document listed, and it'll be in the new book. This is what it is. 1965, the Gemini 5 mission. The Hasselblad camera was a new camera. Now, we have been doing spy imagery the whole time, right? We had the Corona mission, where they had special spy cameras they launched up in space, and everyone's familiar with the Corona. It's a beautiful program. Very expensive cameras, right? Launch it up into space, and then they would drop it down on a parachute, and they would have the airplane pick it up on a parachute. Now, does everyone recall that? I think the Corona program was in 1960, but that's one of the documents included to show how things work. We knew how valuable photography was. We were over there getting bases documented and getting ready. We can target these real easy because we got pictures. They can do that to us too. What they did not realize that turned up in this memo from 1965 in the CIA reading room documents is this. The Gemini 5 mission took their handheld camera and took a series of photographs of their buddies down in Cape Canaveral. Hey guys, look at us. We're up here. We're taking your picture right now. The CIA saw those images. They made a montage. There's a big CIA memo about it. It says, holy cow, we can detect the exact layout of the surrounding area and its perfect ICBM missile targeting data. 1965 Gemini 5 mission was confirmation that we can back engineer from this thing and get horrible military data. We cannot allow this to go on. We need a solution. And the solution they came up with was, from now on, NASA no longer has control of their own photographs. Richard Underwood, our CIA choice, developed every single photo. When you read the NASA archives, he tells you exactly how he did everything. Nobody has ever seen anything but a third generation. That's recorded there. So it goes from him. He's the developer. He's there at NASA. NASA flies the photographs back from the aircraft carrier that picks up the astronauts. He develops it and makes a series, making more than one set from that. He is a photo analyst himself. So he makes some masters. He doesn't say how many, but he makes a couple masters. And he even tells it, I differentiate them because I scratch a number into the negative. So that's another way to tell what grade of master that you have. The first generation film is Saran Wrap Thickness. He makes a couple masters from it where he scratches a number into it. And that Saran Wrap film goes back in the freezer. He says in his interview, no one will ever see it again. That's his testimony. Now, that goes to the 1965 testimony. We now know in 1965, when the CIA said they can target their missiles from these little handheld cameras, what they did was said, no longer will NASA be in control of their own pictures. The MPIC is for military intelligence. When they detected the Cuban missile crisis, the president had to see that right away. These guys are on a hair trigger speed mechanism. That's exactly what they were with NASA too, because NASA was supposed to release and everybody was waiting for the photographs. Underwood sent the second generation. The first generation was locked up. No one ever saw it again, but he made copies in the second generation and scratched numbers into it. He may have done some interpretation himself on behalf of the government to make sure that no one else got to see the second generation. No one ever saw the second generation either, except him. He's the one who made the second generation. The 1965 memo says, from now on, we will get the original, the second generation one. They get the photograph negatives first. They do not go to NASA. NASA does not get to see the negatives. What happens is they go to the CIA, analyzes them, scrubs them, chooses anything that needs to be deleted, chooses things that need to be degraded so that you can't get the information from it. Think when he held up the pictures of the missile silos in Cuba, that was top secret information. Those were
YouTube pictures. And you can back engineer from the YouTube pictures exactly the parameters of the camera they were using. And from that, you can use that back engineering data to match it. There's just so many things that you can get from a photograph. That's why we created the satellites. But the Hasselblad turns out is just as good. So they sanitize the copies, and then NASA gets third generation images. And from that, they are free to release anything in the third generation image. That's because they'd already been sanitized. We all grow so angry in these congressional hearings. Time after time, we hear NASA get up and testify, we have no record of any UFOs. We just don't have records of it. And everybody's going, you're lying. We've got people out here in these. And we're saying, you're lying. You're lying. They're not lying. It's spycraft. It's what David talked about in testimony. Spycraft is a wonderful thing. And what is it? Everybody calls NASA every time and says, we want those photos. The spycraft lets NASA sit on the hot seat because they only have what we have. We sent the photos and NASA never did have. So that's what's going on in these hearings. It's driving everyone crazy. I've got the documents. You can read for yourself. It's coming out in the book in January. That's the document from 1965. I've got the documents from 1965. The creation of the Center, the National Photographic Interpreter, and that's changed names too. It's like a political party. It's like the Republican Party is the Southern Democrats of 1958. It's like spycraft. It's delusion. And we're such a horrible species. It's lucky we can even make a school of any kind, let alone integrate one. We have to be led. We're a vicious, dangerous species, and we have to be led. And protection has to be done for my kids who I know have to fight a war to protect the things we believe in. So I'm for secrecy, but it gets carried away. There are military secrets that can be back engineered from simple photographs. If you gave them the sanitized photographs, they would know what kind of plane it was, the altitude, the flew, the amount of data they can get. Then you are able to develop countermeasures. Anytime that satellite's over, we know it's taking pictures. We'll put our things out of sight. Now, these things weren't known back then. This is in the birth of this form of spy technology. That's documented. Now, here's the other thing that goes on, and I like to go back to the book. One of the best books I recommend to anyone out there, if you read the background and research who Philip Corso was, the day after Roswell, Philip Corso is a real documented presidential advisor. He was working under one of the greatest generals of that time. That general was a magnificent engineer, as was Philip Corso. Philip Corso had a photographic memory, just really wild how smart he was. And I love him, but he looks like the mealy-mouthed, weaseliest little character, short, big black glasses, like Barney Fife or something like that with glasses. A trained killer, and he's a killer documented from the Korean War. And the general he worked for, the reason he did not release that book until 1996 is because he loved the man. He had fought in Korea underneath him, the head of the Foreign Technology Division. The famous Battle of Porkchop Hill, bloody, horrifying battle, absolutely with the last place on earth any sane human being would want to be. He went to the front line up that hill and was there with his men. The inspiration of that kind of leadership stuck with Philip Corso and with all the other men who fought with him. This is devastating to me, how a simple act of bravery, courage, and leadership can transfer into a sense of fidelity and dedication that can only be broken by death. Philip Corso had told him he would not release this information until he was dead, and he did. As soon as he died, that's when he wrote the book, The Day After Roswell. The only problem with certain details in there, Philip Corso takes the stance that he's the first guy in line dispersing all of this UFO equipment for back engineering, but he does not realize they had been doing this. Tesla's the same thing, right? When Tesla died, took all his records, and it went black too, just like what Corso did. So Corso's job, it's called the Foreign Technology Division. You can read all about it. This guy was advising presidents. He worked for a great general. The general gave him a file cabinet of foreign technology from the Roswell incident. They deal with foreign technology all day long. They had spies that went down to Brazil and obtained a copy of a Brazilian machine gun. And it was the best machine gun ever designed on Earth. They caught it. They brought it back. They gave it to their military contractors. They back engineered it. Voila, your modern American world's best machine gun. That's the Foreign Technology Department. Corso said he got a file cabinet from the general. He describes them when he got it right there in the Pentagon. There's animosity between the head of every department in the world. I don't care if it's your ally or not. You can read in the book. He had a little bit of that technology. The majority of that technology from the Roswell crash, he says, went to the Air Force. He was working for the Army Foreign Technology Division. He says he didn't get most of it, but he helped develop the microchip. He helped develop fiber optics. People look back and say they were working on fiber optics much before he gave it to them. That's true. Corso doesn't mention that stuff, but it was the actual fiber optics that he gave them from the Roswell crash that enabled them to come up with the technology and match it
and make it viable. We've got the missing stuff from Tesla as an indicator of the kind of things that were predecessor to Corso. A lot of people discredit him because he doesn't point out the fact that he wasn't the first. He was obviously a key player that finished it up. He'll tell you exactly where it came from. The autopsy of the aliens, the cornea of the alien, when they autopsied it, they determined the light characteristics being done by this membrane. I was eligible for draft age. I lived through that horrible Vietnam War. I saw every night on TV these guys in the jungle sweating, bleeding, being massacred in those horrifying circumstances. But I remember the weapon that they did with that M1. They had a starlight scope. Philip Corso, with the eyelid from that autopsy, was able to the first night vision scope. We did not have night vision scopes. This came from the eyelid of the alien. I remember it well because it came from nowhere. It was a big old orange scope rested on top of your gun and you could see your target at night. I lived through that period and it seemed a little bit aberrational to me. It was just like, gee, where did they come up with this design? Little did we know. You read Corso's book, you get an indication of what he said the time was. Now, the point I'm trying to make to you is another reason these things don't get released. And this is an example of it. In Corso's book, there's a segment where he talks about his job to take foreign technology to America's advanced manufacturing facilities for back engineering. Bell Laboratories knew him well. He would go to Bell Laboratories often and give them a piece of technology and say, yes, this is foreign technology. We need you to back engineer it. And everybody working on it, we don't know where it came from. Some of it was from his UFO files, and that's what his contention is. But there's the stuff that he did all the time that we do know, like the Brazilian machine gun, that was indistinguishable. They didn't tell him it came from Brazil. He told in the book that's where it came from. The animosity between people and government is just as bad as the animosity between your wife and your girlfriend. It's bad. We're human beings, and this is the example. He was taking technology to Bell Laboratories or some other manufacturer. You can read it for yourself the day after Roswell. He was taking technology, and he's a spy. He was in Italy after the Korean War trying to recover Mussolini's purported UFOs, and he was killing Russians over there. But he's a killer, and he's there in the Pentagon, and he had been followed the previous day by who he knew was a CIA agent. So he takes his service revolver. He goes to the CIA agent who was following him to his boss's office. He walks in. This is in the book. He sets his revolver on the desk, and he tells him, if he follows me again, you will not have him. Now, consider what's going on here. This is an American Army officer talking to an American CIA officer. The animosity that arises between departments fighting for huge multi-million dollar budgets is incredible. One half of the Pentagon saying, this is true. We know what Lou Elizondo said is true. We're agreeing with him. And then you have the other half saying, no, he's crazy. The vying for power is the fatal problem of a human being. And it's exemplified by those things. So that is the other part. You've got the valid part saying, we've got to keep these secrets for the safety of ourselves. And the other half is that I'm a human being and my department is not getting enough research money. I want that research money. I'm going to follow and get it. And the other half is saying, no, you're not. I will actually kill your agent and you know I am a killer. So that's what's going on. And then you add the third component that you're seeing today. You're seeing things like Bell Laboratories is not stupid. These are some of the most brilliant men in the world. Now, even though they had the cover that he was delivering foreign technology, some of the stuff that he was delivering was otherworldly. You can tell them, yes, this is foreign technology. The guys are some of the smartest people on earth. When they see the technology, they're going, yeah, foreign technology. Okay, we'll get to work on it. So they work on it and come up with these breakthroughs. Those breakthroughs result in patents, and those patents extend to this day. If you break any information out there that the patent was originally United States government property, you got a load of shit between you and your profits. So there's all kinds of things involved with being a human being that we can't do anything about. But I'm not going to sweat about it. I'm just going to do the best I can and try and have the right morals that shows a way to escape the consequences of my evil nature, just as we all must try. So those are some of the things that I believe explain why these things were being kept secret. And I think there's a logical progression pattern to it. I documented the mechanisms, the CIA documents, the NASA documents. These are all readable. They're all listed. The reason it's unclassified is because, I don't know if we mentioned this or covered it yet, but it's part of spycraft. Spycraft says, and you have to read the history of spycraft, because every time you have a spying mission, it's good for a while and then it gets broken. Originally, in the classification system, classification meant military classification.
according to our U.S. Constitution, the subservience of the military to the civilian means anything the military does is subject to approval by Congress, right? Well, you can't trust these guys with a dime to go down to the candy store and make sure you get it back. And the military knows this too, because military secrets always slip through the fingers of Congress. We see it every day. So they changed the methodology of the secret classification system. So what is a rise of a new classification? The classification called SBU, and it means sensitive but unclassified. And it derives from just this specific thing, what you're seeing right here on this document. And by the way, this document format comes directly from the Gemini 11 mission. That's exactly what the other lithographs and or the photographs, they're lithographs because they had print them on paper, 320,000 pages of it. You can't do photographs in those things. You do a lithograph. That's exactly what it looks like. And this strange object is exactly CIA. There's a whole department of photographic interpreters in the National Photographic Interpretive Center who was making these. This is a sanitized briefing document, and it has to have a heading. It doesn't say UFO. Christ, it should say flying saucer. You look at it, and look, you want to put a label on it, let's call it Gemini 11 flying saucer. But they call it strange object as seen during such and such. The title itself, there's a whole department in there of photographic interpreters.
Let me ask you this. We've seen that photo of the UFO.
Yeah.
Has it been seen in other instances, other photographs and other documentation that you've seen? And has any public officials commented on that particular photograph?
The third book is actually the completion of the investigation. When I started working on this program with Leslie Keene, I told her I've got to get something up because my dad has been with me to all these auctions. He was astounded by what we found. I said, Dad, Leslie will get this published and we'll be really happy. But it was too long of an investigation. I couldn't wait. So I wrote the first book and published it myself just so Dad could see what we had. He died 60 days ago. Mommy's dead too. This is the first important letter to everybody right in the front of the book. It states, this is not finished, but I have to print this because I want my dad to be able to hold this in his hand before he dies. And I did. But just because I printed it doesn't mean I did anything with it. I let it get printed. This book will document every step that gets you to the D-15 experiment. There's three voice transcripts in here. Here you guys, you want to see what a secret document looks like? I think that's mission report. Gemini 11 mission report. Secret for 12 years. And then I've got the other technical debriefings in there. Charles Matthews had a NASA, right? There's his signature page. Do you see that? It says at the top, unclassified. At the bottom, it says unclassified. That's the end of the Gemini 11 mission. It's the exact same format and the exact same size as the lithograph. This is on a 9x11 page, and the lithograph is 6x9, and you can see it just fits perfectly. There you go. Secret. What is that? The Gemini voice communication. Oh, that's what I was going to show you. Voice communication. So what this first book does, these are the voice communication. There, look at this. This is in the book. You can read for yourself their descriptions about what they're seeing out the window. At hour 54 hours, 39 minutes, 42 seconds into the mission, right there. And now when it gets to the D-15 film, there's a military timestamp clock. Every time they take a picture, it gives a minute and second too. So this is evidence that you use, and you have to cross-reference all this stuff. And then it says, whether it's a pilot, the co-pilot saying it. I found three instances. Something go by your window out there. And he goes, let's turn around and go the other way. He wants to turn around and see it. These guys are trained not to let on what's going on out there. Come in. Gemini 11, this is Hawaii. Go ahead. Will you give me a reading on stack 2, Charlie, please? Roger, 2 Charlie's down at the bottom. Roger, 2 Hawaii again, and they're blank. Might as well turn it off, Roger. Go along with it. We plan to stay in blank mode until we get D-15. That's just seconds before they start the D-15. And it's just the indication of the photograph. So you can match it by the second. The D-15, I didn't know at the time. I had to do so much studying to figure out the significance of stack 2 Charlie. The significance is there were 6 batteries running the whole spaceship, but they called them stacks. It's a typical UFO electromagnetic effect. When a UFO flies over a car, what happens to the car battery?
Dies.
Goes dead, doesn't it? The UFO, they saw it out the window, and the second they saw it, NASA calls up and says, hey, check your number 2 battery, and it's dead. 0 amps, 0 voltage. And then within a minute, there's a 6-minute voice gap. The battery had gone dead. We show the recorder monitor operating normally, and then it goes dead for 6 minutes. Richard Haynes says when he's looking for anomalies, he says, I look for anomalous voice gaps, and that's it. So that's one of the first instances. These are in the voice transcript. They're in there, guys. I want you to know that everything is in here in the actual documents. I'm not paraphrasing anything. I don't trust people who paraphrase because I'm the worst liar out there. Okay. Let me tell you, I can mislead you if I choose. I don't choose to do that. We should be approaching daylight. There might be something crossing the coast line here. Oh, that was another meter. It's crazy. Oh, there's one of them. Wow, look at that. What is that? That on our left. It just passed over us. I can't see anything. There's a blossom. Look at that. And then the other guy says, I'd say that's Calcutta. I can't see.
what in the world is that reflected light on my window? These are actual voice transcripts. That's the second one that I thought was anomalous. And then right after that comes 5 minutes of missing transcript. And then there's another one in the 4 minute gap. I want you to read the actual documents. I don't believe someone when they tell me something. I want to read it for myself. For instance, here in the diary, this confirms that he took a picture. What does it say? 15 photo recorder using. I've already commented on that. I took pictures when I thought there was something worthwhile to take pictures of. Greta previously calls it an anomaly. This is the second time they've come over. When, as far as I'm concerned, there were no anomalies encountered with the exception of one. This was late in the fight when we were using the D-15 for S-30. We were fully powered up and we had lost stack 2C and the voltage was getting down there to 22.5 rating they asked us to look. I only took pictures. There were no anomalies except one during the voltage power out on the D-15 experiment. So you're crossing the voice transcripts where they're saying, what the hell is that flying out the window? Let's turn around and look at it. To the debriefing. I'm not military. I do what I'm told. And then we match that with the debriefing. What's the purpose of the debriefing? To get the facts before they're lost. So you've got the facts in the voice transcript and you match it to the facts in the debriefing. This is the evidence we've got. There's the D-15 experiment. Look what you're getting, guys. I'm giving you the documents. These stories I'm telling you are documented. This is not me. And there's, of course, Scott Simpson and all that stuff.
Ed, when you're speaking to the TikTok generation, where they're not going to probably go through 600 pages of manuscripts.
No, that's what the book's for.
But I'm saying that might even be too much for them. The younger generation that's raised on Facebook and TikTok reels, they want that instant dopamine hit and learn something. So how would you encourage them to go look at this? What they would learn and what they should learn by observing and reading this material?
In my estimation, everybody has a purpose in life. Nothing happens by accident. In my estimation, what's happened today is I'm talking to a couple guys who've got a website that speaks directly to people whose mission is the same as my mission. It's a mission of research and thought. Somebody's got to do work. My mission was to read, and I read voraciously, and I have a very strange memory that I can recite most of what I read anytime. Believe me, as a kid, I was like this. I couldn't understand that I was different. It's hard enough to fit in when you're a teenager, let alone when no one understands your jokes. When I was 11 years old during this mission, my parents had bought a 1959 26-volume edition of Funk and White Encyclopedia. One day, I picked it up when I went to the bathroom to read, and I read every single page through all 26 volumes that summer. It's because we're born to do different things. So when you ask about the TikTok generation that is listening to you right now are very intrigued by what you've just presented to them. It's their job to follow through on the analysis. If you know Dr. Diane Powell, she's my cousin, okay? And she's wrote the books on ESP. And she has the ESP files going on now. She's created a foundation. She was taught psychology, clinical psychology, Oxford in England, and at Harvard here in the United States, a brilliant woman. It was synchronicity because she and I have the same synchronicity. We'll get in contact. And she'll mean it when she says, I was just thinking about you, because it's true with us. Somewhere out there in your audience today, because of who you guys are, I have no doubt in my mind. You ask, how do you get through that generation? I don't have to worry about that because there's a synchronicity that leads us all down to our path. You got to this path by many things you haven't taken the time to consider yet and realize just how you've been guided step by step into what you're doing right this minute on your podcast. You have been guided into that. Synchronous events occurred in your life that put you where you are today, just as me being with you is a synchronous event. I was put in your life so that this message will get out to some TikTok generation member listening right now in your audience. And I know in my heart that somewhere out there is someone who heard us today, and he will pick up the book and do the research and be the next great contributor in the search for truth in our field. So that's the way the world works.
Ed, you shared some exciting information with us earlier. You're partnering with the History or Discovery Channel for a series.
Yeah, I've been negotiating today. And it looks like if we come to a contractual agreement, which I'm sure we will, I just want this information out there. I'll be recording for their season 6, January 17th. I've got a lot to get through to them because there's so much information they need to know. Some of this is blockbuster stuff. The stuff you got today, I can't imagine. The New York Times would run an article on what you now have as information. It wouldn't be anything about UFOs. The New York Times headline would read basically this. NASA did not have control of its own photos. CIA documents proof. And it would also be the second headline would be, nobody has ever seen an original NASA photo. That's headline news around the world, just there.
100%.
And it's documented in the two sources that I gave you. You guys recall anything that I've said today?
You did mention earlier, you've done great work. You can tell you have this amazing passion for it and you dot your I's and cross your T's. But you did say something about UFO encounter. You want to tell that story quick? Not for you specifically, but for someone else. house. I forgot the gentleman's name.
Gordon Cooper.
Mercury astronaut, Gordon Cooper. There's a whole chapter.
Richard Haynes from the GEM program, retired. He let me include it in the book because this book is a handbook for how to do studies. There's that TikTok guy out there who doesn't even know yet that his whole life is going to be joyfully devoted to something along these lines. And remember, I told you today, look at that UFO that comes from a Chilean photo and look at the similarity to the Simpkinson UFO. This is like a 20-page analysis. You can see, so you were asking earlier if there's anything similar to it. Yes. So he's got a 40-page report. There's a really interesting drawing from 1966 also. The school incident, you guys familiar with the UFOs that landed on the school playground in Australia in 1966? I don't remember the name of the school, but I was going to show what I found interesting in my research. Oh, and here's documents. These are voice transcripts from Gemini 10. Basically, they're talking about UFOs they're seeing out the window on Gemini 10. It says, do you want to tell NASA? I don't know if I want to tell NASA. They're worried about talking on the voice transcript. And they finally say, okay, tell them. So they tell NASA, have you been listening to what we've been saying? And they say, yes. And then they say, don't forget to censor it. But they didn't. But then again, it was secret for 12 years. I was trying to find the children's photos of the Australian incident the very same year they were overhead seeing the UFO. There are some photos of UFOs that landed in the schoolyard in Australia, and it was a big stink because the whole school was terrorized and they had to send investigators from around the world. 1966 Australian school UFO incident. Search, it'll come up. I had to look through all the newspaper articles because they stymied those people. They had to threaten the schoolmaster who took a photograph with alcoholism and dismissal, just like everyone else. They're not messing around when you get threatened.
Called the Westall.
Did I tell you the story of Richard Underwood? What happened to him in Guatemala and his wife? This is in the Johnson Space Center. Richard Underwood, oral transcript. This is a 2-hour interview. And he says, in his earlier career, while he was working on the secret photographs, he doesn't mention the word CIA, but we know who it is, right? He was working on a mission down in Guatemala. He went on the mission, surreptitious photos. He's a photo interpreter. And when he comes back on the landing field, he tells this story. There on the tarmac was the most beautiful Guatemalan woman I had ever seen in my life. Instantly fell in love with her, and I married her. When the general I was working for found out what I had done, he called me into his office. He said, I should have you shot without a trial right now because you married this Guatemalan woman and you don't have the classification where you're allowed to do that. You can read these documents, and that's what I do. I'm giving you the references. Any of these stories you want to verify, you can verify them. This is what I love about military guys too, because they're just as full of piss and vinegar as anybody on this planet. Because what he says towards me, and after that transpires, you can tell he still remembers that general telling him, I should have you taken out and shot without a trial. We stayed married and we've had 4 children and they all live with us here in Houston and they work for NASA now. What a way. He's rubbing that general's nose and I'm still with the bitch, motherfucker. That kind of attitude. Forgive me, folks, for cussing. I use some of these sometimes just because for me it's humorous. I apologize. No offense to anyone.
No worries, brother.
You can read these stories. Points are in there. The Gordon Cooper story that you were asking about the UFO, I already described that, right? About the UFO he saw when he was building the airfield. Must be Hollis Air Force Base, or else it could have been at Area 51. Gordon Cooper, go to the chapter on Gordon Cooper, tells the story about when he was a fighter pilot in Germany, and he had UFOs fly up in the upper reaches of the atmosphere where he could not possibly reach them. He saw them, and his whole flight saw them. Says, I knew then their behavior. They were intelligent craft being operated up where we would. He says, they were UFOs. I saw those in Germany before he was an astronaut during his fighter pilot days. He describes how we had to keep secrets, and he talks about where you came up with the SBU secret but unclassified. He talks about how we could not let Congress know anything. Every time Congress got something, they blabbed it everywhere, and men's lives were in danger. They did this on the U-2 mission. When they made the U-2, the military craft, under the classification of secret but unclassified, and because it was unclassified, it did not have to be reported to Congress. He talks specifically about when the U-2 was shot down. American public didn't know anything about that, right? What is this they shot down over Russia and this guy Gary Powell? It was an unclassified mission, and that's why nobody knew about it, he said. Nobody knew about the U-2 craft at all, except the Russians, which goes to show how important espionage is, because no one in America knew it, but the Russians knew about it. So in the chapter on Gordon Cooper, he tells the story of what he was doing after he left NASA. When he left
left NASA, he was working still for the military. He was a valuable military pilot, and he had great expertise and classifications that allowed him to do important work without the concern of classification. He reports he was at, I've heard somewhere, of a Hollis Airfield UFO landing. He was in charge of the construction of a barrier at the end of the aircraft runway. He had to produce a movie to show to the generals exactly how they built it, what it was designed to do, and how it was designed. He had a Jeep at the end of the airfield. He had a camera crew out there making live film that they were recording the barrier they built at the end of the airfield. He was in charge of that. He gets a call from them, and they tell him, and you can hear it in the YouTube video, we've just had a UFO land out here. It landed on three legs in the middle of the field. It's taken off now. And he says, wow, we got it on film. That's what they were out there doing. They were filming, and they captured it. And they said, what do we do? He's in charge of it, and he still doesn't know what to do. This doesn't happen every day. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So he starts making calls to all his upper commanders to find out what he should do. When he finally gets in contact with the right person, they give him these explicit instructions. Have them come in right now. Have them take it to be developed. Make sure it's the only film developed. No copies are allowed to be made. Have them bring you that film directly after it's been developed. And you sit there in your office and wait until my courier arrives to pick it up. They didn't say anything about me not looking at film. So I took the film to the window. I looked at the film. And yes, everything they said was there on the film. I saw the UFO. I saw the three legs. I saw it take off. And this is Gordon Cooper. These are reliable guys. These things are in the book. All these hundreds of pieces of evidence. And I'm giving you the location to them. I don't expect people to do the research, but I want to make sure that those who are entrusted, journalists like you, who are entrusted with presenting these facts to the public, know where to go and get this. And you can now say that all that he was telling us is documented. That's your job.
Absolutely. Ed, it's been amazing being able to spend some time with you. I think we could talk all night, right? Like, all conversation.
I've got so many stories, and I'm still, yeah. Can't tear myself away from the CIA files. Now that I've discovered the CIA files.
And I do have one question for you. We always like to ask a conspiratorial question, right? Yeah. And what you see a lot in the news today, and obviously you're connected with NASA, you've done a ton of research. Many people say we have not gone to the moon, that it was faked. What is your opinion on that?
That one, I think, is not a reliable estimation of the situation. My book will show you through the CIA documentation how these things are kept secret. It'll show you that only 4 copies at most were ever made, 4 to 8 copies at most. The MPIC did no more than 25 copies. There is a logical explanation of why no one has seen it, and I can show you the methodology that was used to keep it a secret. Yes, secrets can be kept, but you have to show the methodology how it could be done. It's absolutely impossible that there's any methodology that would have allowed that to occur. That's not a possibility. Not with the live. It's just too far-fetched when you can see the actual space launches. To say those space launches weren't doing what they were supposed to do, and you've got the whole nation following it. There's no evidentiary trail, to my knowledge, that will verify that. It's okay to be skeptical, but be prepared to do the research. Until you show me research where that is absolutely feasible, I will continue to say all of the things, all the evidence I've seen contrary. But that's the important thing. I'm a skeptic. Those of you who believe that, prove me wrong. Find the evidence. That's what it's all about, evidence. We can't trust each other. We're human. I salute you for your skepticism. Find some evidence, because the evidence I know is contrary to that belief, but I could be wrong.
I appreciate everything we talked about tonight, Ed. You've been a fantastic guest. Can you remind folks where to find your book? Where can they go out, seek it out, and find it?
You can order it in any bookstore if you know the title. Have them look it up. Ed Wilson. Just remember, not Bart Simpson, but Simpkinson. I put pictures on the book. Look at these UFO pictures that are NASA photographs. Those are NASA images, and it's on the back of the book, A Report to Congress by Ed Wilson. That's the UFO. That's the D-15 footage. I tried to put as many pictures as I could on the covers of the book. My books are expensive. I intend to make some money from it. I quit my job selling stuff to auction houses and putting stuff in museums. When I found this lithograph, I had to quit my entire job that I made a living. I had to spend thousands of dollars to publish all this stuff. Anyone who has a problem with making money from your labor, I like to go to the Bible. Jesus said, don't muzzle the ox while he treads the grain. Gotta make it, man. We're humans. And I may be fat, but I still like to eat. So I quit my job. My income suffered because I found something that has absolutely absorbed me. When you find it, it's like a man who finds a great pearl buried in a field. He sells everything he has to buy that field. That's what happened to me. I put everything
thing I did to make money, because there is the pearl in the field. I would have done this without remuneration. That's why, but I do try and put this information out there so that you don't have to buy the book. These photos are beautiful. Look at it. You want to see some ICBM components? Wow. 9x11? These launch photos. Look at these things. Look at that Wallops Island. Look at this. This stuff is amazing. Wow. It's the best history on earth. It's a story that has never been told, and it pulls together all the ends of our frustration. What you're going to get, I believe in my heart, you're getting the final story that explains why we've had all this subterfuge and problems and how it was done. That's what I feel.
I agree with you, Ed. You've been fantastic. Like I said, we enjoyed every minute with you. I encourage reach out to you, watch you on your History Channel show, jump on Amazon, pick up a book. Gotcha. Yeah. But yeah, pick up the book on Amazon or your local Barnes and Noble bookstores.
The reason I tell them to go to Amazon, I tried to put those pictures on the cover. You can look at the cover on Amazon. It's important to get the information out. I've got a website. Seth LaMancusa is my technical director, who you guys have met and spoken. Wasn't able to be here tonight, but he has a website, and he may have sent it to you, the link, but it's called Gemini 11 UFO on YouTube. Seth LaMancusa, Gemini 11, and you got to spell 11XI. So Gemini XI UFO, you can download photos, film footage from there, his Dropbox connection. I want this information out there. I want a couple bucks, but you get what you pay for too. I'm proud of my work.
It's great work.
I don't mind charging for it.
As you shouldn't be.
Yeah. Go to Amazon and look at the pictures. You don't have to pay for those, and let it stir your imagination.
Thank you so much, Ed. Until next time, we are Zero Signal.
We're out.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next signal. Follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.